Ignition sequence start. 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back to University, everybody, the podcast where we explore the hard-hitting questions about Earth, existence, and the unknown. I just showed up to the studio about 5 nanoseconds ago. I'm AJ Perrin, your host. With me is my co-host,
Judson Martin.
And this week, we're going to be talking about gravitational waves.
They're the things that make the world go round.
Not really.
No.
It was a topic that was voted on by our Patreon subscribers, so thanks to them for letting us know what we need to be talking about. But before we get into all that jazz, I have so much news to talk about.
You wrote down a few news segments to go over, just a few.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's 5, which is more than usual. Usually I try to stick it to 3. I wrote down so much news that this, you can consider this basically a debrief on everything that's happened in February in science and even early March. So
everything?
Everything.
You didn't miss one thing.
No, there's not one. There's only 5 things that happened in February, and we're going to get into all of them. The first one being that TikTok, I posted a video about this on our Instagram. TikTok is potentially getting banned. We've seen this before in the past. Like, this same committee has tried to do the same thing in Congress, but now it's a bipartisan bill that's going to a vote soon. If the Chinese parent company, ByteDance, doesn't divest the company because Congress is saying that company has ties to the Communist Party and that they don't want them to have our data, whatever. If they don't divest the company, then they're going to remove TikTok from app stores in the U.S.
Bummer. I mean, I don't know. Maybe TikTok going away is a good thing. Everyone go to Instagram Reels instead.
I don't care. I don't even care if it's for the wrong reason, which maybe is a bad thing to say, but I don't care if they remove TikTok even for the wrong reason. I'd be okay if it went.
Probably an overall positive on society.
Yeah, it would be a net positive on society. But people are a little concerned because they're like, maybe this is a First Amendment infringement or... it doesn't say that you have the right to TikTok in the First Amendment. You can say whatever you want on whatever platform you want, but
pretty sure George made sure that was in there.
Yeah, but they're worried that maybe lawmakers just want it gone because that's where people talk about politics and stuff like that, which could be a bad reason that it's leaving. Or
I don't know about you, but my For You page does not have a lot of politics related stuff.
Yeah,
on it.
People are also concerned because they think maybe the government is thinking about our productivity as a country, and they're like, we need to get rid of TikTok.
Maybe.
Hey, that's a good thing, though, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, that's probably
that's the good way to look at it.
The net positive.
Anyway, the act is called the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act, so you can go look at that if you're interested. But otherwise, we got to move on because we got 5 things, and we're on low on time.
On this, but like we learned about... what was one of the Stamp Act? Like in like high school history class.
Oh, not together.
I learned about like the Stamp Act. My point is we learned about that and then kids in 100 years are going to learn about TikTok Act. I don't think that infringes on free speech either. There's so many other ways that you could share your free speech.
Exactly.
Like, on any other platform.
Like Twitter. Except Twitter is more of a problem in my opinion than TikTok. So like, but.
You can say anything on Twitter though.
Yeah. They're only looking at TikTok because it's a foreign controlled app. Now we have to move on. Second piece of news, NASA created a Dungeons & Dragons-style tabletop RPG. It's called The Lost Universe, and it basically, I'll read you the description. I posted a video about this, too, on our Instagram. I literally posted that just a couple hours ago before I got in the car to sprint over here. But here's the description of the campaign. It says, a dark mystery has settled over the city of Aldastrin on the rogue planet of Exlaris. Researchers dedicated to studying the cosmos have disappeared, and the Hubble Space Telescope has vanished from the Earth's timeline. Only an ambitious crew of adventurers can uncover what was lost. Are you up to the challenge?
Sounds like we have to play.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've never played a tabletop RPG or anything like that, but I would...
Aldastrin and Exlaris? Are these real exoplanets?
I hate to break it to you. Aldastrin is a city, and I don't think we're naming cities on other planets yet.
Oh, okay.
But Exlaris also probably isn't real if they're... Well, first of all, it does not roll off the tongue, so...
No, not really.
So that's free to play. You can go to look it up, The Lost Universe from NASA, and you can download like the game guides and everything to get started or whatever. You're taking on a villain while learning science skills and things about the universe as you play and then applying that knowledge. So it's a learning opportunity too. But it's not like one of those not fun learning activities you did in school that was like a quote-unquote game too. This is like, this is legit.
Yeah, that's real.
People are getting hyped for this. So I'm gonna jump on the train. I'll probably be like what kind of character do I want to be?
I wish the audience could see that motion that you just did.
If you're on Patreon, you can.
That's true.
I guess I'd be like, I see myself as like an archer kind of, but it'd be like since it's a sci-fi based game, it'd be like a futuristic archer and not like Hawkeye. Like I'm saying, my bow automatically reloads and I like shoot beams of light. Anyway, moving on. You have anything to say about that, Judd?
Not really. I mean, I think the game would be fun.
Yeah. But let's get some people together.
I've never done a tabletop RPG like that before.
We'll have Matt be the elusive Matt be the game master or whatever. He'll
lead us through. If it's free to play, then, you know.
Yeah, why not?
Go ahead.
Anyway, next piece of news. 3 new moons discovered. And before I even say it, if you've listened to the last episode, you know who discovered them.
Scott.
Yeah.
Scott Shepard.
Scott Shepard. I didn't even, when you sent me that this article, Judd, like I didn't even have to look in it to know who discovered them. I was like, BFFR. Yeah, big shocker. One moon has been discovered orbiting Uranus. It's the first one in 20 years, so it's breaking a pretty long streak. And it's also the faintest ever found on around any of the ice giants, which is why it's been so elusive up until now. And the reason it's been hard to spot moons in these planets is because the only real close-up observations we've had have, besides telescopes on planet Earth, which I wouldn't consider close-up, is Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 flybys. Actually, I think it was just Voyager 2. But anyway, so Scott Shepard found these moons using the giant Magellan or Magellan?
Magellan.
Are you sure?
Yeah, that was the name of my soccer team that I played on back in the day.
Oh, okay. The giant Magellan telescope back in November and December of last year. This is the most powerful telescope on Earth. And so when I heard about it, I was like, we'll do an episode on that in the future and about how that works. But anyway, also with the Neptunian moons, those are the other two of three moons that were discovered. They were actually first spotted in 2021 September, but they just needed to collect more and more observations to confirm their orbits and their presence.
We don't need to check Scott Shepard's work.
Yeah, if Scott Shepard points in the sky, like, you know, he's cooking. Yeah, there's a moon there. But anyway, once they determined the orbit of the moons, what I thought was cool is that they could trace, or one of the Neptunian moons, they could trace it all the way back to a picture that was, or an observation that was taken in 2003 of an object that was in a different observation. So they were like, oh, where would this have been back in the past? And then they lined it up with something they've caught so long ago. So it's been literally right in front of our noses for 20 years.
I feel like we take so many like readings and images of the sky and things like that. And like when we talk about how many stars there actually is in each one of those images, or I guess some of them, stars, moons, planets, whatever. I mean, obviously we haven't discovered all of them. There's so many even just in one picture.
What I want to do when we have Scott on is ask him about what makes spotting some moons so difficult, because that's what he talked about in the article, was like...
When we have Scott on?
Yeah, when. It's like, you know, the stars are moving in the background and you have to distinguish what objects are what, because they look the same, you know, to us. They kind of just look the same.
I feel like moons are hard to like, I think, see on their own, because... Like they don't emit any real light, or they don't emit a lot of things, so they need something to be shining on them to see them, you know.
It's kind of like spotting asteroids, if you guys remember our moon rock episode. Is it's like, how do you spot things that don't emit light, that are super tiny and moving really fast and uncontrolled?
Yeah.
The Neptune moons will be named after lesser sea gods, because Neptune is the Roman god of the sea. Shout out Rick Riordan for writing the Percy Jackson series.
I don't know if I know
Neptune.
All the names without him, man.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Who would, really, if we're being honest? He made, just like we're making space accessible to people listening, he made Greek and Roman mythology accessible to a younger audience. So kudos to him. If you're listening, Rick Riordan, if you ever hear this, I'll send you a signed t-shirt. Yeah, yeah.
You'll get the
one with the signed t-shirt.
We don't want the signed book. We just want a sign.
We'll trade. You send us a signed book, deal. You get a signed t-shirt.
I have a signed copy of one of his books, but it was just like, I don't think it was his actual, I think it was just like a print of a signature.
You know The Maze Runner, that book series?
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I wrote a book report on The Maze Runner, the first one, and my teacher sent it to James Dashner on Twitter, and he sent me a message about it.
Cool.
Yeah, I think I didn't remember his story quite right, but I was pleased that he didn't call me out on that. So that's pretty cool. Anyway, and then the Uranus moons will be named after Shakespeare characters. I think that's how they usually do it. Got to move on. Next piece of news. Europe is building a new super collider. We'll do an episode on super colliders in the future. But basically, if you don't know about super colliders, there's one in existence right now. It's called the Large Hadron or Hadron Collider. And they basically shoot particles together really fast in a vacuum chamber. And they haven't discovered a whole lot with that project. And so they're like, we need to shoot things together faster and with more energy. And so they're building a bigger one.
If you like are in the side of that vacuum chamber, when it goes off, you turn into the Flash. I don't know if you've seen that, but
yeah, this one is going to be 91 kilometers long, and it's going to be underneath the French and Swiss countryside.
It's a good spot to have it.
Yeah, it's meant to study the Higgs boson. Yeah, it's like peaceful. You know, you
Swiss.
Can camp in the daytime, and then camp in the nighttime and throw together particles in the daytime, but.
I think about the Swiss countryside, and the first thing that comes to mind for me is a particle accelerator.
Yes, same. I'm like, this is a pristine landscape. Wouldn't it be great to just like put a 91 kilometer circle right here?
Yeah.
Perfect. They're under a little bit of pressure right now, the people planning to construct it, because how do you convince investors to build this thing, which is not easy to build if you didn't discover anything with the first go round? But I hope they do it anyway.
I think, well, we have.
It's better to try it and fail than not try at all.
And we've discovered things from the Large Hadron, just not like exactly what we were looking for.
It's not new physics, really.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's going to be $17 billion, so a little bit of chump change. Moving on, we measured gravity at a quantum scale. This was a little bit of a gloss-coated title when I saw this article pop up, so I'm not going to jump into it too much, and we'll wait to see like more information about it. But Nature is reporting on it, that science journal, which is a good sign for any new research. Basically, right now, if you've listened to us in the past, we've talked about how there's like regular classical physics, and then there's quantum physics, and there's no theory to combine the two. These scientists at the University of Southampton and some other ones in Europe that I'm misremembering, so sorry, they've been trying to measure gravity at a quantum scale. So take super tiny particles and measure that particle having a gravitational effect on another one.
Yeah.
And hopefully try to bring us closer to understanding how gravity works at a quantum scale, right? And so basically how they did this is they had these levitating magnets, which were superconductive, and they're also known as traps, just like, I don't know, they're just called traps apparently. They built these to experiment on tiny particles, levitating them in freezing temperatures that were 1/100th a degree above absolute zero. So if you know anything about experiments we've talked about in the past, like with quantum computers, it's like if you want to work with super small particles, you just have to basically freeze them.
It's a lot harder to make something really cold than it is to make something really hot.
Yeah, that's a good point, because you can always add heat, but to take away heat is more difficult.
Yeah, because in order to take away heat from something, you have to have something that is less.
Yeah, heat. And it has to efficiently draw heat away.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But it's interesting to see, like, this discovery is on a quantum scale for gravity, whereas the rest of this episode, we're talking about the largest scales.
The largest scales. Yeah, that's a good point. Oh, was that all five?
Yep. You nice. Did it.
I didn't start a timer, but I think that was pretty good timing.
Yeah.
You want to roll into brain games now?
Of course.
Okay. You go first.
All right. So,
welcome back to Brain Games, our segment where we talk about some random stuff we learned.
Don't ever interrupt me ever again.
Okay. Like it hasn't happened before.
No. So my Brain Games is less of like a question or a fact. It's just something to think about. It's a prompt for your brain. So recently we posted a reel of we were discussing how whales actually came from land mammals. They evolved from land mammals. Came from land and just went in the water and then never came out. He never came out again. And then they somehow evolved into a whale.
I just think,
it's a new species.
Yeah. I think it's the reason we posted it in the first place is because it's just surprising for me to think like at some point they were like a semi-aquatic species and then one guy stepped foot.
He just never came out.
And he never came out. He's like, you know, it's pretty
lit.
This is lit. Yeah, this is way better. You know, nothing's trying to eat me up there. I'm the big dog in the ocean. And so now we have giant blue whales. And I actually didn't, you know, I don't think that much about biology on a day-to-day basis, but it's like you forget that most of the animals in the water aren't mammals. Like mammals are the odd ones out.
Yeah.
And mammals only showed up because they were on land at some point. So it's true with all mammals.
We went from only stuff in the ocean to, well, and then stuff on land. And then now I guess they decided they want to go back to the ocean. Land was not that cool. The real thing to ponder about on this one. No. That wasn't my intention. But yeah, I mean, I'm just funny on accident most of the time. The real thing to think about for this is, as humans are going into space, a new domain, such as it was for this land mammal that decided to stay in the water for his whole life, what if when we go out into space and we have humans living in space, what if we evolve into a new species because of the new environment that we're living in?
I don't think that humans are the end of the evolutionary timeline, but I also think that it would take a long time for us to change into anything else.
It's just kind of interesting. I guess I don't really think about the fact that things are still evolving today, you know?
Yeah.
We're just
right under our noses.
Yeah.
And remember
we are.
Remember when Tim was on? I'm always getting better on a day-to-day basis.
Well, yeah.
Remember when Tim was on and he was talking about like how, depending on what time frame you look at, like nothing is in homeostasis.
Yeah.
Like he was saying for entropy, this block of aluminum may just look like an aluminum block, but it's like, that's because it seems like a stable solid.
We're observing it at like a one point in time.
Exactly. My brain gains is that I found out in Germany it is illegal, like against the law, with fines of up to 500 euros, it's illegal to idle your car. And the reasoning being because it's noisy and it pollutes the environment. And I dug into this a little bit more to find out if people were happy or not happy in Germany about this. And I found that the environment is a little bit different there, or the climate is, depending on what part of the United States you're in. But they don't care because they've learned that it wears down your engine faster if it idles. And so it wears down your car faster than if you were to just start driving your car, albeit slower, once you start it.
Like right away, you're saying?
Yeah, like right away. So that was a little...
Interesting. So maybe what we've been told is wrong this whole time.
Well, and I was like, well, I don't know if I should trust just this one person saying this, but I found out also that German automobile makers
don't... The same thing?
Well, yeah, they don't create remote start keys or remote start capabilities. Not only because it's illegal in Germany and they're probably selling a ton of their cars there, but because they understand that as well. Like even if you import them to the United States, you'd have to get that feature added to your car as a US model.
Interesting.
Yeah. Whew. That's it for news and brain gains. You want to take a break before we jump into gravitational waves?
Sure.
All right.
All right. So
let's jump into waves.
Gravitational waves. We're going to ride the wave here. So we've talked about these a little bit in some previous episodes where we've talked about, for example, we were talking about space travel and we were talking about how we could use we could ride a gravitational wave to go faster than the speed of light.
Warp drives. I forget we even did that episode. It was
a while ago.
Yeah. We have talked about gravitational waves in the past. Everything in the universe is pulling on each other no matter the size. Bigger objects like planets and stars and whatnot have a greater force on one another, but even small objects all the way across the universe from each other are in some ways physically tied to one another. And so when objects, the big ones, interact, we get to see this physical interaction crop up as gravitational waves, and it's easier for us to spot these with really large, quickly accelerating objects, which, spoiler alert, everything in the universe is accelerating in some way because there's not a corner of the universe you could run to where you wouldn't be affected by gravity from something.
These gravitational waves are just created when anything is accelerating through space, like you said, because it's when you're accelerating through space, you're contracting it in front of you and then you're expanding it behind you, like we've spoken about. So it's going to create a wave.
Yeah, there's like a dynamic action that takes place in the space that you move through. A good way to think about gravitational waves visually, which gravitational waves take place in a dimension that we can't directly observe. Here is a visual to kind of aid that. So if you think about like a bowl of water the top flat part of the water, imagine that is, that's just a 2D plane. Now, if I drag a spoon, imagine the spoon is 2D in line with the water. If I drag a spoon through there, it's going to cause ripples around the spoon.
Right.
And now the ripples have height and depth when they move up and down. And that's that third dimension that didn't exist before. So the same thing when we are in a 3D space and 3D objects start moving through it, there is a response
in a
higher dimension. Exactly.
Okay. That's interesting. I didn't think about it that way.
Yeah, I was really working through that in the car ride here. I was like, I got to make sure I kind of get this right.
Literally the motion of the ocean.
Here's some interesting points about gravitational waves that you may have not heard of if all you know is basically what we've just spoken of recently, which is gravitational waves are these things that are always moving through the universe and these big objects create them, right?
Yeah.
These waves travel. I was like, how fast are these moving towards us? They travel at the speed of light. If gravitational waves travel at the speed of light, let's say you could look out into space with a telescope and see a black hole collide with another black hole, right? An example we'll get into later. If you see them collide, the moment you see them collide, those gravitational waves from that incident just hit you.
They're hitting
you,
yeah.
If you can see it, you can feel it, you know, no matter the distance. I think to me that's crazy. And then I expanded upon that by saying the present moment for every individual is dictated by light speed. What I mean by that is if you go to the other side of the universe on a different planet, right? Judd, you're on planet B.
Okay. I like that one.
Yeah. You're 500,000 light years away from me. So when my light hits you, I'm already 500,000 years in the future from the point you're seeing me at.
Right.
If the present is dictated by light speed, then everything in the universe is at the present moment is also physically connected by these gravitational waves moving at also the speed of light. Does that make sense?
Well, I think it does make sense. I think because you can feel the effects of gravity from these objects.
Yeah.
Well, quote unquote feel. I mean, they have to be very large to do that, but we've never experienced anything like that before. But yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. There's a constant state of gravitational waves. Like there's a constant like wave going around us at all times. It's called the gravitational wave background. We have a few different reasons that we think that might have happened. So one could be, the main one is that there's a series of orbiting binary systems, like you talked about, where it's two black holes orbiting each other. And when, since they're accelerating so fast when they're doing that, they're creating these large gravitational waves. And if we think about a pool, right, if you throw one ball into that pool, there's going to be one like set of ripples that are coming off that ball and going in a circle. But if we throw 10 balls into that pool all at once, then there's going to be just a bunch of ripples going along the surface, and you're not going to be able to understand, or you're not going to be able to predict what those waves are. They're going to be random.
Yeah, it's just this whole mess of waves.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always thought when people compare gravitational waves to ripples in a pond, it was like cheesy, corny, like too simple, overly simple. But the amount of connections that you can make is insane, because the other layer of this is that gravitational waves, not simmer isn't the right word, but
well,
dissipate.
Yeah.
They dissipate with distance.
Right.
That phenomenon is due to what some scientists call the stiffness of space. So space is like naturally trying to resist whatever is happening in this background. And I'm not trying to like dive into it too much, but when we first talked about like dark matter and dark energy all those times ago, like I feel like there's some connection between the fact that gravitational waves can't go on forever, and yet they're massless, don't interact with, it's not like throwing a football through air and it slows down because of air resistance. There's some other, the hidden forces in the universe that reduce these
things. Like, I think of the bedsheet example where, you know, you have a bowling ball and a bedsheet, and that's kind of like the idea of space-time. If you pull it tight, then you can have an easier wave, but it'll also dissipate more over time, I think.
Yeah, because they dissipate, that means that it's the really big objects, preferably closer, but the really big objects that create any significant gravitational waves. And these are the ones that scientists try to study. And by studying gravitational waves, they can determine properties like the mass of the object and the movement of the object. There's a couple events that can cause waves. I just have a little list. It's collisions of dense objects like neutron stars, so things physically colliding with
one
another.
If two of you went at each other, you're pretty dense. It would be a big gravitational wave. Anyways.
A star imploding, going supernova, could cause gravitational waves. a remnant gravitational, you already mentioned that. The remnant gravitational radiation. There's also non-spherical neutron star rotation, which I thought was interesting. So basically saying if the star is rotating but not perfectly on its axis, this could cause ripples. I didn't imagine that objects bigger than a planet could ever be not perfectly round, you know, because the gravity, shouldn't the gravity balance it out?
I don't know. Another theory that I saw for that sort of stuff was called cosmic string collisions. And I don't even really know what that means.
Oh, we'll get into string theory sometime.
But I don't know. That just seemed really crazy to me.
Now that we talked about what gravitational waves are, let's talk about how we study them, why we study them, what we're doing with them. So Albert Einstein first actually predicted the existence of gravitational waves all the way back in his theory of general relativity, I think, 1916. And his mathematics showed that massively accelerating objects within the fabric of space would be causing ripples or disruptions in the fourth dimensional space around it, or the higher dimensional space around it. And the first proof of this theory, and now Albert Einstein also said that there was no experiment that you could do at any reasonable scale to prove they exist.
Yeah.
Wrong.
Oops.
Oops.
Turns out he wasn't an all-knowing being.
Exactly. The first proof of gravitational waves showed up in 1974 from the work of Russell Hulse and Joseph Taylor. They were basically looking at a binary system of pulsars really far away, and they said that, well, general relativity says that if these two things are orbiting each other, they should be kind of creating gravitational waves. And by studying their orbit and how quickly they were moving together, and by tracking the radio waves emitted from this orbit, they determined that something else, some other force, must be acting against or disrupting this motion, right? Yeah. There's whole weeds of math that you could get into, but basically they're not orbiting in a way that would be possible without gravitational waves.
Right.
I think I said that right.
I think that's like, well, and yeah, that just comes back to the idea of general relativity, where it's like, if you're observing someone in free fall, if they jump off a building, this is how Einstein thought about it at first. This is how one of the smartest people thought about and came up with his good idea, is he thought about somebody jumping off a building.
Yeah.
And if
that's
how
I start my science classes.
Yeah, always. Someone's falling off a building, right? They're not experiencing any forces if you observe them from their own perspective, because if you're following them as they go down, because then they're actually standing still. Because if you're going with them at the same speed as they are, then there's no forces. It's the same idea as if you look at someone in space from their own perspective. So that's where he got the idea of, okay, these people are the same. But then when we take the lens back and look at them from a third person perspective, there's forces on both of them, and they're both accelerating. And so this force has to be opposed by something. And so this is the creation of gravitational waves, like the resistance of space-time, as you were talking about it.
Yeah. The guys I was talking about won the Nobel Prize in Physics. Now we have the LIGO, or the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. This is the primo site for studying gravitational waves, and we've talked about it in the past before. But basically, in 2015, they found the first observation of a gravitational wave because they were studying two black holes that had been circling each other, I think billions of light years away, and they finally collided, and the gravitational ripple was what reached us in 2015. Now, the collision from these black holes released energy that was 50 times greater than the combined energy being released from the rest of the universe at that given moment. So this was a huge, like, universe-shattering event, right? Yet when it got to us, it was barely noticeable, and that's that dissipation effect due to distance. You'll see just how barely noticeable it was when we get into how LIGO was designed. So basically, it's a huge facility with giant arms 3 or 4 kilometers long, stretching in perpendicular directions. The length of the arms are measured from lasers at the point where they meet. So like a laser will shoot from the end of one arm and be reflected back, and they can read they can read how long it took to travel.
Yeah.
Now, when gravitational waves hit us and stretch and compress space in ways that we can't feel at all, the time that it takes the laser to get down and back has changed, and that's how we know we can observe gravitational waves, is those tiny, tiny changes. The signals that hit the LIGO from this collision lasted less than a fifth of a second, but still was enough to be measurable, even though the changes in the length of the arms are measurable down to like one 1,000th or even 1/10,000th the nucleus of an atom.
So very, very small.
These changes are barely anything, but when we're measuring with lasers, we have that super high accuracy. Now, one thing I did think about was gravitational waves stretch and compress space. Wouldn't they also stretch and compress the light from the lasers? But because the light from the lasers are continuous, yet the gravitational waves are not, because they're ripples that happen one after another, the laser is still able to read the compression and expansion.
Yeah. When we think about these, you know, arms that you're talking about being a certain length, it is a physical length of that long. But the length that we're measuring it in is time, because we're, like you said, we're measuring how long it takes for these lasers to get to one length of the arm and then back.
Yeah. Some other interesting facts about the LIGO is that with the lasers were built with the smoothest mirrors ever created, because they needed to be pretty precise, and also to make sure that they were independent of the shaking of the building as it stretched and compressed. And I say shaking, but it was, like, you know, obviously barely noticeable. They were suspended. The lasers were suspended from silica threads. So, like, these really tiny fibers, but really strong silica, right? Holding them up. I wish Tim was kind of here to talk to us about why that material was specifically picked. But anyway, not only was there one LIGO facility, but there was two. I can't remember where they both are, but that's to make sure that what the lasers recorded wasn't from environmental noise, because they're so fine-tuned. It needs to happen in both places for you to be certain.
There's LIGO. That one's pretty sweet. If you actually want, you can help the LIGO research studies on a website called Zooniverse. Z-O-O-N. Didn't-iverse. I've talked about it before.
Yeah.
But they have a something where you can go and identify these signals that the thing is experiencing, the detectors are experiencing, and you can classify them as whether it's an event or if it's just noise. Or so you're helping out the scientists train an AI that can do it on its own eventually. But right now they need some human help to get that figured out. There's LIGO, which is pretty sweet. I mean, it's on Earth. Boring, actually. I take it back. It's boring. What if we built it in space? Because that's way cooler. So
this is the first time I'm hearing about this too.
The European Space Agency decided that that was a pretty cool idea. And so they teamed up with a bunch of countries. And a couple years ago, they spent up a LISA probe. So this was just a test to make sure that, hey, if we're going to go ahead and send up this other mission, that it's going to work. So they sent up the LISA probe. They got back all the good information. So now they're going to build LISA, which is a laser. It's called Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. Pretty sweet. It's essentially LIGO in space. It's the same sort of idea. They're shining lasers at, this time, three satellites instead of just two. So it's forming like a triangle.
So you can get a way bigger distance, too, if it's up in space.
Yeah. These arms are 2.5 million kilometers. Pretty freaking big.
Yeah.
The interesting thing, when you think about a satellite, you're thinking of something that's going to orbit Earth, but actually these satellites are going to orbit the sun and travel behind Earth. So they're going to follow Earth's orbit, but behind Earth. Pretty cool. But yeah, 2.5 million kilometers for each of these arms. So they're going to be able to, it's going to allow us to measure even smaller gravitational waves.
Because distance is greater.
So a wave, you know, will have to travel that whole distance, and then it'll create a bigger change in time. I feel like that's got to be like the biggest thing we've ever made
in terms of size. Like, yeah, size. System size. Yeah, for sure. Actually, definitely.
I don't actually know that for sure, but that seems like it should be.
Yeah, unless you could consider Voyager 1 or Voyager 2 like communicating with Earth.
Okay, so yeah. That's pretty much all we have for gravitational waves.
Yeah, we sped run that episode, but it felt really good.
We had a lot of news that we wanted to cover, and I think it was all interesting stuff. So
plus, it kind of worked out because I didn't mean to talk about, first of all, we talked about the microgravitational stuff, and that kind of sat well with the gravitational stuff. And then we also talked about the new Hadron Collider. To me, it's the same idea as building a LIGO. It's like we hadn't directly observed a gravitational wave. Even the guys who won that Nobel Prize I was talking about, that was indirect measurements of gravitational waves. They were saying they should exist because of what we're seeing in radio waves, but we hadn't measured the gravitational waves until the LIGO. And so it's the same thing with this other facility. Like, build a big facility and hope that you see what you're looking for, you know? Because I bet they had to feel so good when they first saw the gravitational wave.
Like, Einstein was right. I don't know. I know this is where we got to wrap it up here.
Yeah. Thanks so much for listening. If you like what you hear, Make sure to leave us a review wherever you're listening, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. We'd like to hear back from you guys, and follow along on our Instagram to make sure you're caught up with everything that we are doing. This episode was voted on by our Patreon subscribers. If you want to get involved over there, you are more than welcome to. We've got live streams of episodes. We've got video episodes, Q&As that you can get answered on air. We'll answer your Q&A questions here in upcoming episodes where we do like a whole stack of them. Right, we've got, you can vote for the episodes, you can get merch discounts, you can get entered into merch drawings, free stuff, all that cool jazz, all while supporting the show. And then you can just come chat with us and tell us what you want. What do you want from us? You know?
Yeah.
Anyway, we've also got our merch shop, pocketscience.com. Also, the link is in our Instagram bio to see all the cool stuff we're doing. I got a new drop coming in April or the end of March here, so we'll see what you think of that. Our listener shout out today goes out to everybody who's listening from Illinois, Elgin, Illinois specifically.
Why? What's going on there?
I don't know. I was thinking about that butterstick thing we were talking about on the ride over here to the studio. I was like, man, thanks for listening from Illinois, nowhere else. Also, shout out to our Wednesday listeners. Also, people who listen while baking. Also, people who are in space while they listen, ISS astronauts. Thank
Please
you so much.
Please DM us if you're in space.
Yeah. And finally, people. Thank you. People.
People.
Thanks.
Thanks to people.
All right. See you guys later.
Bye.
Bye.